TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Sweet Liberty. Are we living in a police state yet? I'll begin with a quote from Milton Meyer about Nazi Germany. This is what he says about the Hitler regime. The taking away of freedom took place slowly, each step disguised. One no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day it is over his head. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. Suddenly it all comes down all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or, more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. You remember everything now, and your heart breaks. Too late. You are compromised beyond repair. This is an account of the arrival of fascism in Germany in the 1930s by Milton Meyer, an American journalist of German Jewish descent. This program raises the question, are we living in a police state yet? Lynn Stewart is the attorney for Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, an Egyptian cleric in exile in the U.S. He's imprisoned for allegedly having inspired the first World Trade Center truck bombing. The government now claims that they have the right to sit in at meetings of lawyers and their clients, and charged Lynn Stewart for distracting a guard who was spying while the translator was speaking to Sheikh Omar. Lynn Stewart was arrested on April 8, 2002, and accused of helping terrorists. She's out on $500,000 bail and threatened with 40 years imprisonment for doing what has been the common practice, the norm, and the rule for lawyers. Lynn graduated from Rutgers Law School and has practiced law for 26 years. She has represented the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army. She spoke at a benefit in her honor held in Berkeley, California in July 2002, where she received a standing ovation. Lynn Stewart.
I'm in trouble. The Attorney General of the United States said so on David Letterman. And so it must be true. He was sure in his own mind that he is keeping the world safe for the John Ashcrofts of the world. But when I say I'm in trouble, we know that the tide as it runs right now is not the same as the tide in New York City or the tide of the Bay Area. We know that in the hamlets and the small places of this country, people are frightened. And when people are frightened, they turn to the government to protect them, no questions asked. And I think our greatest job, and my greatest job, and I'm before you tonight not because I face 40 years in prison, and Barbara, I'm not looking forward to it. But I'm not here because I face 40 years in prison. I'm here because for 40 years I have fought against injustice in this country. And I don't think I have to say it here, but I urge it as a way of life for all of us. I think I would just like to relate to you some of the facts of the case, because you know the way the media works is basically they run a story and they repeat it enough times it becomes reality to most people. And although the media does latch on to the grandmother story and the personality story and the fighter story, they don't really deal very much with the real hard facts of this case and what it means to all of us. Because, you know, underneath it all, it really isn't a case about lawyers. It isn't about lawyers' rights. It's about the client's rights, the people's rights. Because if the government is permitted to listen in on the conversation between a lawyer and a client, the entire process, as imperfect as it is totally perverted. As an example, suppose that you were stopped for driving while intoxicated. Not a big case, not a big deal. But a big deal to the person to whom it happens. That person chooses a lawyer. He goes to the lawyer and he says, first of all, I was at Joe's bar and I knocked back 6 beers real quick. But I'm pretty good, I can handle it. And I went to the police station with the cop and he made me walk the line and touch my nose and do all the things that they made me do, and I did them all. But he wrote it up in this report that I didn't do them. But my friend, Max, works at the police station. And he saw me, and he knows I did them all. And we can call Max as a witness. Now, that person is not going to speak to a lawyer if the ear of Big Brother is listening. He is not going to be able to reveal that. Because by revealing it, he has given away, first of all, that he was indeed drinking, which he doesn't have to do under our system. He needs admit nothing. And he has also given away the name of his only witness, which the state will certainly move on. The state will certainly make sure Max is not available as a witness or that Max changes his story. So there is really no way to defend the person. So then what is the next step? Well, let's do away with the next step. Let's do away with due process. Let's do away with trials. Let's do away with it all. But the chilling effect, probably the bedrock of representing another human being for a lawyer, is establishing the kind of trust. And you can imagine, you walk into a place, someone is charged with a very serious crime, and here's the lawyer. And you've met the person, talked, been retained, maybe even been to court. But when you get down to really talking about the case, first of all, for that person to trust you is an enormous leap. And to ask him to trust you when the government could conceivably be listening to everything he says is an absolute travesty of all that the process is about. He cannot trust you. You cannot defend him. You cannot defend him. You have eliminated, for the people who want it eliminated, those pesky lawyers who seem to fight for people, who seem to get out there and try to make things happen. So for those reasons, we must fight this case, and we will fight this case, not just because lawyers need a privilege, but because clients need a privilege, people need the privilege in order to be able to discuss and be represented by a champion of their choosing. My case is basically revolves around the fact that in 1995, I represented Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. He was accused of a far-ranging conspiracy, mainly hatched in the mind of an informant who was determined to, while working for both the Egyptian government and the American government, was determined to help the FBI lick their wounds after World Trade Center 1. They had been caught really in a serious way with no information, no way of knowing what had happened after that. It was mass confusion. They talked Croatians, they talked Puerto Ricans, they finally settled on the Arabs. This case was the second case to come out of the World Trade Center, and my client, although it's always reported in the media that he was convicted of a conspiracy to blow up the World Trade Center, he never has been convicted of that, and he has never been charged with that. The case was a case revolving around the possibility that certain New York landmarks were targeted. And he was convicted of that, and without going into a lot of detail, I do believe that he is wrongfully convicted. And I believe that because I do not believe you can convict the bishop of the Catholic Church who preaches against abortion when someone of his followers goes out and murders a doctor at an abortion clinic. And in this instance, it is exactly the same. Is he a militant preacher? Yes. Did he tell anyone to go out and do this? Was he part of the plan? No, he never was. But the climate, and when I say the tide is not running in my direction right now, the climate in America was such that they wanted people like this off the street. And when the United States attorney summed up in that case, he said to the jury, "You have the right to be free from fear." And although we rose, all 12 lawyers in the case rose to object, it was allowed. And he went on to say, "You may eliminate fear, basically put these men in jail, and you will not have to fear anymore." And that is basically what our government says today. It says, support us, give us a free hand, and you don't have to be afraid anymore. Well, the events of 9/11 proved that that was not so. And the only thing that will save us is if we can have a mature, an intensive, a realistic appraisal of why 20, 19 young men were willing to give their lives to cause this kind of mass destruction. But that is not the focus that we take. Our focus is other. And we know why it's not the government's focus. The reason is obvious. This is the way they solidify and they are able to do all of their dirty work without having to really have any opposition, because the people are willing to go along with it. And the question here is, are we willing to go along with it, and what can we do? The toughest question for the left is always, what can we do? And the answer is, organize, organize, organize. I'm here to organize. When people first went out in an anti-Vietnam demonstration, they were very few. I can remember marching on the United Nations in New York City to protest the war in Vietnam, and I don't think there were more than 200 or 300 people there. But it grew, and it grew to such proportions that they had to listen. And it grew to such proportions that everybody that marched was empowered by that. We knew we could change things, whether through the usual, internecine fighting of the left. We never accomplished all that we hoped and believed and trusted we could do in the 60s and 70s is a judgment we all make, I think, those of us who were there and perhaps the generation that comes now. But we have other opportunities, and this may be it. Earlier, Mark was talking about checking the website for the State Department to see if your contributions might be on their list. You know, it could be a lot easier than that. Aren't you materially aiding a terrorist organization when you come here to hear me? John Ashcroft says, I'm aiding the Sheikh. I made a press release for him. When you come to hear me and clap and offer me support, are there going to be wagons lined up as we exit tonight? We may laugh, but we may not laugh forever. The charges against me basically deal with the fact that I'm charged with conspiracy to materially aid a terrorist organization, that being the IG or Gamaat Islamiyah in Egypt, and actually aiding a terrorist organization. And the gravamen of that charge was a press release that I made for Sheikh Omar out of the federal medical facility in Rochester, Minnesota, when he was incarcerated there. At the time, the government had imposed upon him something that is known as SAMs. This is Special Administrative Measures. They are in place for approximately 15 persons who are incarcerated. One of them is Leonard Pelletier, as well as the Sheikh, as well as some other folks that have ordered hits from jail, etc. The Sheikh, of course, is blind. He is diabetic. He takes insulin. He has a bad heart. He has a myriad of health problems. He is incarcerated in such a way that he is never in population. He does not attend religious services. He sees and speaks to no one because he speaks Arabic and very little English, and the guards are instructed not to speak to him. He is isolated in a way that I think is unthinkable for everyone in this room. He cannot read because he is blind, so he does not even have the comfort that most of us would find in being able to have a book to pick up. He has nothing but his own inner resource, and that is great, because he is a person of tremendous inner resource. And whether you can agree with his principles or his religious beliefs, he still is a person who was on the world stage, who is tremendously respected in the Middle East, and who is listened to by his people in Egypt, who have been trying to get rid of one of the worst dictators, Hosni Mubarak, a country that accepts aid second only to Israel. The Sheikh has opposed Mubarak. He is elected. The U.S. loves democracy, but Mubarak is elected running by himself every 4 years. Mubarak has bought his own island in the middle of the Mediterranean, I assume, just as Mobutu, a place to run to when if it gets too hot ever, and a place to enjoy the millions he has ripped off from all of us. And it is from all of us. The children of Egypt eat from the garbage pails and the piles outside Alexandria and Cairo. And the Sheikh is basically, and the CIA confirms this, and everybody that we spoke to in the course of the trial, he is an Egyptian nationalist in the sense that it is his country that he wishes to have liberated. And it is not in the traditional sense that we know it as the left. I'm not talking about Fidel and the grandma. I'm talking about a person who believes in an Islamic state. And when I am asked about this, I always repeat that I believe in self-determination, and I will not substitute my cultural values for the people of Egypt. My 7-year-old grandson said to my son, who's a lawyer and practices with me, Grandma really helping the terrorists? And my son said, no, they're lying about her. But the reason I repeat this story is to show the pervasiveness of that word, to show that when they put that T on your forehead and say, this is a terrorist, not even knowing what the word really means, but knowing it's a bad thing, 7-year-old Arthur, who loves Grandma, who is happiest in sitting on my lap listening to Rumpelstiltskin, will ask his father and will believe because it was on that pernicious tube. So I think that's one thing we have to fight. Just the fact that they're saying it doesn't make it so. And the other thing is, and the name and the reason why we're here tonight is, are we approaching a police state? And I think that we have to think about the notion, and I'm going to quote from my old friend Bill Kunstler, with whom I did trials ad nauseum in the late 80s. One of the things that was quoted from him was when he was reflecting on the government's crushing of the Black Panther movement. And I would just like to say parenthetically that although we're here talking about the coming of a police state has existed in the Black communities, the Latino communities, the Chicano communities of this nation since their inception. And Bill said, and this is quoting only in part, "The key to survival, of course, is to be able to hear the booted tread before it stops in front of your own door." The booted tread is out there. It may not be marching down the streets yet, but that is where it wants to go. And while we can have, and my husband and I had a great laugh the other day, we were up in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, speaking to people not unlike yourselves, although in smaller numbers, some people who have been back in the woods for the last 20 years because they, like many of us, have become cynical, have become disillusioned, don't think people can be organized, but they came out to this meeting at another Unitarian church in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, probably as far from Berkeley, geographically almost, as you can get. And the point I'm making about that is that in St. Johnsbury, we spoke to them about the police state and the police state coming. And it seemed very unreal in this idyllic backwoods place, but yet they were ready to hear about it too. And Nancy's List, and we had a great laugh because in the Burlington paper that day, they had written about how the librarians of Vermont had made a statement that if any FBI agent came to them and asked them to reveal what people were reading, they would have to be very, very sure that that person was being charged with some serious crime before they were going to give up that information. I was delighted. I started my career as a elementary school librarian, which is how I got involved in the school struggle that both Jeff and Ralph were part of, too. But we started talking about this. And we thought of the government taking out the list of what you or I has read from the library or ordered on Amazon or on Books a Million or whatever website you like to buy your books at, and how they would make decisions. Now, are they still going to take the people who read Marx? Do they go to the maximum security jails, or do they go to they're okay, they can stay out. But anybody who reads the Al-Qaeda statement, they're in. I mean, it is so ludicrous on the surface that it is laughable and jokeable, and you can laugh and you can say, well, maybe if I read King Salver's Poisonwood Bible, that would put me on the A-list. But if I only read Her Prodigal Summer, which is a book about sex, not about imperialism in Africa, that might keep me off the A-list. And to think that the FBI would know the difference? But when you take it as a whole and you think about what they are empowered to do and what they think they can get away with in the name of homeland security, and the very name sends a shiver down your back. It's the Weimar Republic all over again. It's the jackboot on your neck and saying, we can do pretty much what we want to do. I was interested in one of the earlier accounts of my arrest in April that someone remarked that Ashcroft thought because of my pugnaciousness and political views, I would not receive much support. Well, you are the answer to that. And John Ashcroft, because he comes from a background which says that slavery is not an evil, that his slavery was merely an economic condition, something which he will not condemn. And John Ashcroft, who anointed himself with oil on the day of his inauguration because he is loyal, first of all, to God, which raises some serious First Amendment rights, he is the poster boy of his campaign. And he has selected me, and I am the poster girl of this campaign. And I promise you that we will fight him to the end on this.
That was attorney Lynn Stewart from New York. She was arrested on April 8, 2002, and accused of helping terrorists. She's out on $500,000 bail and threatened with 40 years imprisonment. She spoke at a benefit in her honor in Berkeley, California, in July 2002. This was part two of a one-hour program on the question, are we living in a police state yet? I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on the topic of a police state on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get a copy of the full one-hour program with Lynn Stewart for $12. That includes shipping. A transcript is $10. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Moriah Gelaudin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.